Okay, so I'm going to kind of follow on from some of Sri's discussion, talking about radio follow-up in the LIGO 02 and 03 era, and I'm referring specifically to 02 and 03 because we're in the year of discovery, and when we find an afterglow in the radio, I'm sure our strategy will change drastically, but for now, it's sifting the parameter space we have to get through to find that first afterglow. And as Duncan said last week, in 02 and 03, we're kind of into the parameter space where we do actually expect to see potentially the first inspire that includes a neutron star in the system. And I think the hunt is on now to try and get that first afterglow. So should we give a kind of overview of the various kind of channels you might expect to see radio emission, varying from the highly speculative pixie dust, as Dale Frail calls it, the kind of coherent bursts that are hard to quantify and they're poorly constrained, but they could potentially be an exciting tracer, all the way to the tried and tested eject impact in the ISM, where you can very easily determine what, once you have, you've got to explore parameter space for eject energy and for ISM density, but when you have that constraint, you can actually very easily push down into the regime we expect an afterglow. And then in between, you have the other channels that Sri mentioned, which of course is the jetted radio emission you might expect associated with the jet. And then he also discussed the magnetar formation channel. So I'm just going to talk about how you might optimize your surveys for these various channels, but mostly focusing on the latter, because that's really where the bread and butter will be, because that's the one that has the lowest risk. It should be ubiquitous, and it's the easiest one to kind of get predictions for. I'm going to start off, though, with the pixie dust, with the highly speculative coherent emission, just very briefly, because there have been papers put out that predict these low-frequency radio pulses that will be essentially prompt. There may be some delay associated with those bursts because they have to come through an ISM, an IGM, through which they'll be dispersed. There'll be dispersion in that plasma. You might have delay of seconds or minutes. And a lot of large new low-frequency radio telescopes are now gearing up for O2 to try and basically be ready to trigger very rapidly to try and look for that kind of emission. And I'll give the example of LOFAR that Sri mentioned. There's also MWA in Australia. And then I'm also showing an array we've just built in Owens Valley called the Owens Valley Long Wavelength Array. And all these arrays will be geared up for O2 to try and trigger. I'll give you an example of our own array because I can talk most confidently about that. This array images the entire sky every 10 seconds or so. We're going to be operating for the entirety of O2 and O3. In our case, we're imaging the entire sky and we're buffering. So the data rate's enormous because we're combining lots of signals together, about 30 terabytes of data per day. And we buffer for 7 days, and when the triggers come in, we're not trying to slew to that location, we're actually looking back in our data and putting out the corresponding images and looking for the transient. Here's an example of a single all-sky image with that array of 10 seconds integration. There's about 3,000 galaxies in here, and the idea would be when the trigger comes in to put out those images and do a search. And MWA and LOFAR have similar efforts, in their case, to trigger and point at those locations. Okay, moving on now to the more tried and tested methods where you've got eject impacting into the ISM and you can kind of estimate what the likelihood would be for emission. You've got the case where you've got you've got the jet scenario. Of course, the jet, there is uncertainty because you don't know what the inverse beaming angle might be for jet and emission, be that associated with the GRB or otherwise. There's also the orphan afterglows as those jets become subrelativistic. And the uncertainty there is you don't know what that inverse beaming angle is. There are constraints from short GRBs, but there's no unbiased measure of that. So in this case, looking for these afterglows, you may not have a measurement, you may not get a detection, but you do have constraints on that parameter. Similarly, as Sri mentioned, you've got the magnetar formation. These are the millisecond magnetar planarians that have been injected with huge amounts of energy. In that case, the uncertainty is you don't know what the formation channel rate is for those objects. And once again, when you look for those events, you may have a very low chance of detection, but any observations are constraints on that formation scenario. And then finally, we have the ubiquitous bread and butter variety, where you're not getting as interesting physics as you get in the optical and IR, but what you do get is you get calorimetry, and you've got a very good chance of detection if you explore the parameter space appropriately. Now, the question we've been trying to deal with radio astronomy is the same as what's been dealt with in optical IR, and in fact what's been pioneered in optical IR. Do you want to try and survey some localization area with your telescope, Or do you try and be clever and pick out those galaxies in the localization volume and hammer down those galaxies with more sensitivity? And this is the kind of strategy that's been worked on in the optical and IR and high energies, for example, Casagrande Lab 2014. And in order to do that, you of course need to have some knowledge of those galaxies in that localization volume. And there's a number of catalogs that have been assembled of galaxies out to the Advanced LIGO horizon in order to try and be able to do triggered observations where you're triggering only on those galaxies rather than on the entire localization area. One example you probably hear about later on from Monsi is the senses of the local universe, and that's the one we actually will use here for our reference for radio. Now, for radio observations, you've got the three scenarios I mentioned there. The real question, the real trade-off here is between completeness, because your catalog of galaxies is never going to be complete, and then your sensitivity to the full range of ejecta energies and ISM medium densities, right? If your emission was bright enough, if your telescope was sensitive enough, you just do a blind survey. But you have to assess that trade-off. And that strategy, you must do this strategy every time for every A-LIGO run, because the A-LIGO horizon changing really does change the parameters you need to explore for each telescope. So with that in mind, focusing on just O2 as an example, here's the cumulative distribution of the likely distances for the blue line being nuclear-star mergers and the green dashed line being nuclear-star black hole mergers. What I want to put across here is that for the purposes of planning and observation, the median events are about 100 megaparsecs and 150 megaparsecs. This comes from simulations based on Singer et al. 2016 that we just used for a recent proposal. And this plot really summarizes the kind of choice you make for a given telescope. Here I'm showing the distance in megaparsecs. And initially, I'll just focus you on the right side here. This is basically the completeness of a catalog, like the senses of the local universe that Monsi's developing. What you can do then with your any given telescope is decide, for a given distance, am I better off focusing on those galaxies, or should I do a blind search? So let's take the case of the JVLA, which is the most powerful interferometer in the US. And still in the world at the moment, that can be used for this kind of experiment. So if you take the median case of a neutron star merger at 100 megaparsecs, what you can see is that Monsi's catalog is about 60% complete. And that's actually, I think, a slightly out of date number. Monsi can update later on. It's probably more like 80% for O2. So you basically have a catalog of about 80% of the stellar mass that you can target directly. Now, for any given telescope, you can actually establish what is the gain in integration time for each field of view by targeting only galaxies rather than trying to do a blind search. In the case of the median event in O2, you're talking about a gain per galaxy of a factor of about 50 or so, right? So you've been actually, and that corresponds to a huge increase in the parameter space you can explore. And I'll show on the next slide why that's important. So various telescopes, I mentioned the VLA, Meerkat in South Africa is coming online, and ASCAP in Australia are three, I think, the probably main competitors for this kind of emission. They all have to make their decisions based on their field of view, their sensitivity, and where they are on the planet. Because in the JVLA's case, we're in the northern hemisphere. It's very sensitive. It's got quite a small field of view, and we've got a great catalog. The choice, at least for O2 and O3, is easy. You target galaxies, and you integrate down on those galaxies. For Meerkat, it actually has both good sensitivity and a decent field of view. More likely that you want to target galaxies, but it's marginally favored because it depends how complete your galaxy catalogs are.
You mentioned 80%
of the stellar mass?
Yes. Or, I mean, this galaxy has a likely
face on the star. No. Yes. Okay, sorry, so it's more luminosity than mass. Okay. And ASCAP, it's got a very large field of view, but it actually has quite a low sensitivity. So it really is better off doing a blind survey. So each telescope has to make these decisions, and they have to make those choices for every new advance of LIGO's capability. What I really want to point out, though, is that there is the other advantage you have in the radio, in that your afterglow, at least the canonical late time dynamical mass, dynamical interaction with the ISM, that rise time is typically of order months and maybe even years, right? So you actually know where your error localization region is well before your observations. So observations for the CLU is surveying, you know, 3π steradian, trying to get a galaxy catalog. But now you know 3 months in advance that this particular 150 square degrees is really important, and you can actually hammer down with the other facilities and actually complete out that galaxy catalog well in advance of your main science data. And that's something that we can really do in the radio. We can actually build the catalog after the GW detection. Okay, so getting down to the brass tacks of why this is important, this is some plots similar to what Sri showed earlier on from a recent paper from Hurakzak et al, where we kind of looked at the light curves and we were comparing various telescopes and various strategies. So here I'm taking the same event, 100 megaparsec double Epsilon merger. I'm going to show a range of energies. First, I'm just showing eject energy of 1051 ergs per second. And what I'm showing here now is the expected light curves for various ISM densities, right? And what I'm showing then is the sensitivity limit given to you, in this case 7 sigma for blind survey and 4 sigma for target galaxies, of your radio observations by these two strategies. And this is for an example of a campaign that we've submitted where we're trying to do multiple, well, 3 epochs, 15 hours per epoch for a number of events in the 02 and 03 time frame. And what you see is that by focusing on target galaxies rather than a blind survey, you can probe much deeper in parameter space in ISM density, and as I'll show in the next two slides, in ejecta energy. The trade-off is you lose, a certain amount of completeness, but it's going to be at most 20%, and it really is probably the right choice to make, at least for O2. So for this 15 hours per epoch, that's basically the blind survey is surveying a 150 square degree localization. The target galaxies are targeting all CLU galaxies in the volume, including your localization area, but also your distance precision. These observations will start like weeks after, so your localization distance will actually be pretty good too. And factoring all that in, you target those galaxies rather than targeting, and you get that factor of 50 or 100 more per galaxy in integration time.
I think
in O2 and 3, the actual error region, it's going to be similar to O2B, right, when Virgo comes online. And this median number was based on O2B, assuming Virgo comes online. And even with the reduced sensitivity, you do get better localization, right? And that was where we got that number from for our proposal. Okay, moving on to lower energy ejecta, and your constraints are weaker, but you're still when you're targeting galaxies getting down to 0.01 in ISM density, and then finally the worst case scenario, which is low ejecta mass energy and low ISM density, you start missing out some of the events, but it's only at the very very corner of that parameter space. Okay, now I'm just going to show very briefly as well, in this case I'm showing a plot from Sri, which kind of shows the typical light curve you might expect for a magnetar. And in this case, doing the exact same analysis, assuming 15 hours for the same region, what you find is the following. It's much brighter, right? In this case, the blind survey cuts through here, and actually your targeted galaxy is somewhere down here. So you actually are better off in this scenario not to target galaxies, because you're losing the trade-off you make in completeness is actually a net loss, right? You're better off in that case doing your blind survey, and arrays at the VLA are now equipped to do this on-the-fly mapping that Sri mentioned, where you're just going to automatically map these regions very very shallow, looking for this kind of event. And Sri already has a program in place looking for this kind of event. So contamination. I want to briefly touch on contamination because it was mentioned earlier on as well too. So here is a plot of the parameter space of some of the extragalactic radio afterglows you may expect to see. And this plot shows luminosity, and it shows the time scale to get to peak luminosity. The filled circles corresponds to be optically thick basically synchrotron self absorption at peak brightness in a given band. In this case it's 3 GHz, and the hollow ellipses are awfully thin. at the time of peak light. It's adapted from a couple of papers that we worked on. So what I want to establish here, you might hear the phrase, the radio sky is quiet, which is a good thing. I want to quantify that. When we say the radio sky is quiet, what we're saying is, within the localization volume for advanced LIGO, there are not many events that you will confuse with the neutron-star merger. Sure, there are supernovae, but unlike in the optical, the merger is a lot brighter, typically. And even in the cases where it's not brighter, and there will be some overlap in that parameter space, it's optically thin at peak time. So if you're actually doing a monitoring campaign, it should be very easy to distinguish between a supernovae and a binary neutron star merger event, especially when you couple in optical surveys that are surveying for all the supernovae in that volume also.
Let me ask a different question. It's a related question.
So sure. You mean from our radio surveys we've been doing?
Or anything you're intending to do. Just what's the rate you expect to get, if you know.
Oh, you're saying how much more, you know, that's basically what Sri showed earlier on. What's the rate of type 2s in the same volume? It's about, you know, maybe 40 times larger.
What you're saying, only in radio.
Only in radio.
Yeah, it's very small.
How many radio supernovae?
Okay, how many obscure supernovae you're asking, basically. The numbers are not well constrained. There is some fraction of obscure supernovae, but I think that those obscure supernovae are the ones that occur in, you know, the more denser star-forming regions, right? And if you look at the typical separation of like galactic nucleus and neutron star merger, well, short GRBs, for example, the median separation is 5 kiloparsecs, right? Whereas the typical obscure supernovae are in much more dense, compact, you know, certain. No, we do. We do. We have a program that's ongoing that actually is exceeding in parameter space what this is trying to do.
But we haven't found any radio supernova yet.
That's right.
The point is that it does take an effort to get to that, which is why this plot goes on.
That's
fine. Yeah, we've done a survey over the last 2.5 years that surveys the entirety of Stripe 82, which is 300 square degrees. Down to 100 microjanseys or so. So in terms of parameter space covered, it exceeds what we'll cover in this survey. There's a survey starting as well later this year, which is the VLA Sky Survey, and that's going to do a factor of 100 times greater. It's doing the entire sky 3 times. So that'll be a constraint we'll have on that separately. Okay. So yeah, when we're saying the radio sky is quiet, what we're saying is that there's no at least in the volume you're exploring, there's very few contaminants. There's no foreground fog of M dwarfs flaring. The radio bursts you get from M dwarf flaring are sorry, go ahead. Right. Right. All I'm going by is basically what we have from previous radio afterglows, like this one here, where the evolution timescales are typically much longer and it's optically thick at a, you have this cascading optically thick spectrum that comes down.
But that's based on the radio spectrum.
That's right.
That's
right. And there's been deep searches for type 1As in radio, and there's been no detection so far. So they're down in a parameter space down here somewhere.
Sure, but I mean, in some ways they have similar kinetic energy.
Sure. Right. So I think the surveys that we're doing now at the VLA and so forth, where it is not biased in the same way, we'll have some information on that, I hope. And we're still working through our Stripe 82 data as well, too, to try and constrain some of that. So. So, yeah, there have been some very deep pointings recently in radio, but yeah, that was my understanding as well, was that it was the ejecta energy. As Sri mentioned earlier on, it's the ejecta energy and the and the density, the energy of the ejector is much higher, even though it's a similar mass. I don't know what the exact beta is, but they're higher than type 1A, certainly. So with regards to M dwarfs, the contamination from the foreground is essentially zero because the M dwarf radio bursts are really limited to very nearby events, up to 10 parsecs or so. Now, what is the problem is the background haze. Never mind the foreground fog. The background haze of AGN, that is a problem, and it will be a problem more and more so as the range of the advanced LIGO future generations increases. And there's two forms where the AGN are a problem. One, of course, is AGN within the galaxy that you're trying to, you know, the galaxy you're trying to target inside your localization volume. So, right now that contamination rate isn't very high for O2b and for O3 because it needs to be an AGN within the galaxy in the localization volume with greater than 25% variability to be a contaminant for our searches. And you know, you're talking about a few hundred galaxies that are in that area, in the volume rather. And the fraction of those that have AGN is already quite small, but the fraction of AGN that are variable is only a few percent. So the chances of variability there are very low. And in any case, there's a way, once you have a possible contaminant, there's an easy way to try and get over that. And that's basically by looking at higher spatial resolution to try and separate or to localize better to where in that galaxy that source is, whether it's an AGN or not. And you can do that by going with the VLA to higher frequencies, and that gives you better spatial resolution. Or you can just, you know, trigger the VLBA or some of the VLBI antenna. It'll give you like milliarc second localization on that radio source. And then you compare that to, you know, to your typical projected offsets for short gamma ray bursts, and indeed what models show, and you can say pretty easily there's a very small likelihood of it being a contaminating source. Now, what's more worrying is AGN that are behind the galaxies in your localization volume. And I'm showing a plot here that's not, all our previous plots were ones that we've adapted for the median case of a 100 megaparsec event in O2b that has a localization of 150 square degrees. This is now directly taken from Hodak-Czak et al. 2016, and it shows an event at 140 megaparsecs with a 90.5 degree error localization area, and in showing those same three examples of, you know, low, medium, and high ejector energy, and we see that basically what we're trying to show here in blue is the AGNs in your volume that might have that might be variable, and those AGNs behind galaxies, right? And we begin to see as you go to lower flux densities, you begin to become more and more contaminated by galaxies that are popping up, AGN that are popping up behind your galaxies, right? These are AGNs, and not in the volume. These are AGNs out to whatever. That's right. So these are AGNs in the galaxies you're looking at, typically. Almost certainly. Whereas, you know, as you get to lower and lower radio flux densities, you're hitting more and more of the AGN population. And there's a couple of, you know, a few percent of those are variable. Now, it's actually not as problematic as it might seem. This is for all variables. These are typically, you know, varying by, you know, 20%, 30%. They won't have a factor of 3 or 4 variable. Now, that at least helps you. But as you go into further and further into the scenario where you're looking at greater distances, it becomes more problematic to deal with. And you have a likelihood at that point having a variable or transient source that has a variability index that, you know, is quite high. It varies by a factor of a few and can mimic your event. That helps. They're very often gigahertz peaked. They're very often gigahertz peaked, the ones that would be contaminating this. And that's right. And you're monitoring over time as well, too, right? You're monitoring over time, and you can, you know, whereas your merger will evolve, they will be going up and going down and going up and going down. Yeah. But they're behind galaxies. Yeah. Yeah. So you can look in deep, you know, in the near infrared, and sometimes you can look through those galaxies and pick up the spectrum. We've done that before with the transient. So. Yeah, that's right. You really want to have a very defined strategy for the AGN problem. I think it's very tractable for O2 and O3. You just have to work harder when you get beyond that. And the last thing I'll mention is star formation, because the program we're trying to do is with the VLA, and it has variable configurations. So it goes from four configurations, A, B, C, D. A being the most extended, so it just basically transports along these arms. D being the most compact. And the reason it has these configurations is to be sensitive to emission of different brightness temperatures, right? You may want to be able to do very high resolution imaging of a point source, or you might want to monitor star formation or measure star formation in nearby galaxies, which is diffuse. And you don't want to resolve that out, so you have to have a compact configuration. For the purposes of a LIGO follow-up, it's like getting a grade. A is always better than D, okay? And D is a problem because, you know, what I show here is an example of 2,417 star-forming galaxies within 100 megaparsecs, down to the luminosity of about the Milky Way. And what I'm showing here is the peak flux density. As you can see, that when you change configuration, when you go more compact, emission that you were previously resolving, you're no longer resolving, and your peak flux density increases. So what I'm showing here is, ignore the dashed lines and focus just on these two lines here. These are the two worst configurations. The blue one is S-band or 3 gigahertz D-array, and the dashed one, sorry, it's the two blue ones I want to focus on, is this guy right here. So the two blue lines. They're the frequencies we're going to be using for our follow-up. And what you can see is that the brightnesses of galaxies due to just synchrotron radiation from star formation gets pretty high when you're in the more compact configuration. In fact, we can quantify that in terms of our sensitivity. We expect that it's this red line here corresponds to the brightness at which a source starts to be a problem for in terms of contamination. And it's about, you know, in the worst case scenario, about 30% of the galaxies may pose a problem in that they're brighter, or they're four times or more brighter than our transient popping up. So we can very easily, we've been doing these transient surveys at the VLA, and we can measure 25% variability very easily of a source. But if your source is 10 times brighter, it starts becoming a problem. Now, we have ways to get around this. For any contaminated source, once again, we can do follow-up at high frequencies. And we've proposed to just use the VLA and immediately go to higher frequencies and resolve all those contaminations. Looking at the schedule and how it compares to Advanced LIGO, the deconfiguration finishes in May of 2017. And after that, all our problems go away. So that's just another contamination to keep in mind. What determines the configuration? It's this fixed, so there's competing science cases to do different configurations. Groups who want to do star formation in the local universe want to compact, measure low surface brightness. Those who want to do, you know, images of, you know, brown dwarfs want to have it in a large configuration. And how the VLA does it just does it four configurations cycling every 4 months continuously. So the problem comes back in 2018 again, but from, you know, and it's a tractable problem, but it's just something we have to deal with. From May 2017 all the way through to June 2018, it's not a problem. So that's the bulk of O2B and O3. Oh yeah, you can. And we've actually incorporated in our program. We can just switch to higher frequencies. You know. But yeah, but it's just easier to go to higher frequencies with the VLA because. Possibly, but if you're resolving out something, it has a very specific behavior, and you can determine that pretty fast. It'll have, you know, a typical new to the minus 0.7 spectrum, and then it'll be resolving out. Whereas a transient, a proper transient, will be equally compact in the high frequencies and the lower frequencies. So it should be. Sure. So we're getting spectra. Yes, emerling. It's just really hard to argue with the VLA sensitivity. It's just a real, it's a big gorilla sensitivity-wise. It takes a lot more time for all the telescopes to catch up. GMRT won't come close. It doesn't go up to the, it only goes up to about 1.4 gigahertz as well. So, but it's easy to build this into your program. You just re-trigger rapidly on that. Okay, just to summarize, Sri already made this point. New facilities are coming online, and the search and radio for afterglows is definitely a priority for all of them. There are programs that are ongoing and proposed for all facilities. In all cases, your strategy must be carefully adapted to your population, and it will evolve as your advanced LIGO window changes, or horizon changes. The JVLA is what we're focusing on because it's ready now, so we can do observations this year, not wait till the end of 2017. And it's exceptionally well suited to the search for ejecta ISM afterglows in O2 and O3. And it really probes very deeply into both ISM densities and also the ejecta energies. Contaminations are definitely negligible for O2 and O3, but I foresee in the future there may be more involved strategies required to remove contamination. And I'll stop there. Thank you.
One thing that's been bothering me for a while is Ato Berger's claims about the separation between GRBs and galaxies has a very large fraction of them way that out where the density is probably way lower than 10 to the minus 3. But it seems to me that there's also a problem that there are way too many compared. If you look at the galactic distribution of pulsars, the rate is dominated by the very low velocity ones that never get out there. So I'm somewhat mystified.
I have the exact same opinion as you. I have the exact same opinion.
So part of this thing is if it's in the Milky Way, the potential is quite big. And so the Milky Way has a larger fraction not getting kicked out that far. But if you're forming a lot of these guys in low mass galaxies, they will go farther. So that's.
I understand that. I've done that calculation and I still have a problem.
So if we accept the data does look
but they have to be copious, but they also have to not be copious producers of 10 kilometer a second kicks, which the Milky Way is a producer of. So it has to be a different population of kick velocities.
And it's a very small number of events too, right? The well, for the radio afterglows, at least, that have there were constraints on the ISM density. There's only like 4 or 5, right? I think, for the radio. Just the general, yeah, okay. But it is something that I've been puzzled by. The rates that Sri showed from your calculation, Ron, I assume was based on at least partly the galactic population. And they're in the disk and they're going nowhere. So at some point they have to be found by LIGO. And they'll have if their ISM is faster. If your detection rate with LIGO is high enough, and you've got some fraction that are corresponding to the Milky Way population that are in the disk. Their rise time is so much faster. They might be the ones you see first, even though there might only be a fraction of the rate, because they're rising faster.
Still, for a 1A supernova,
there's good evidence that there are two distinct channels, maybe even more, but at least two morphologically distinct channels. There are supernovae 1A in elliptical galaxies, which actually look different. They're more subluminous compared to spiral galaxies. And the rates actually go as, the blue times this, and the red times that. So it's not unreasonable to think that there are at least two different channels, too. Now, why one will produce low velocity, I don't know. Okay, then now we'll get into maybe electron capture, maybe it's a heavy IMF, all that sort of stuff. But I think that's again, understanding that is critical for detection, because if these guys in the intergalactic space, it's very bad news, no matter how you look at it.
The concern is that the Milky Way birth rate of double neutron stars is dominated by things with 10 kilometer a second kicks, not with the traditional 200, whereas the GRBs is completely dominated by things which maybe they don't. I mean, to get that distances out even, forget the potential, you need kicks of hundreds of kilometers a second.
Is the argument for
Right, but that's the problem, right?
Well, but pulsars in general, then you have a problem with the pulsar velocity distribution.
No, I agree. Well, there's a problem with the double, I think, with the double neutron stars.
Okay.
It's just a question of the problem between the soft gamma ray bursts and the pulsars. I think there's a problem. Okay. And that the answer to that kind of affects what fraction of double neutron stars LIGO might be able to find in low density versus high density. The ones in the Milky Way will be great for the radio. The ones that are 100 kiloparsecs from anywhere are going to be hopeless, I think. So.
If the kicks are like going with 200 or something like that, there's going to be a significant fraction that won't have a host galaxy, you know?
Right, but it's probably in the Milky Way, that's not true.
Sure.
Okay, so our final talk of the morning is Marcella, who'll be talking about the dark energy camera survey follow-up to